Good evening. On behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Council on Foreign Relations, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program on the subject, Why Limited Force Rarely Works. We are honored to have with us this evening a Senior Fellow for Conflict Prevention at the Council on Foreign Relations, Micah Zenko. My name is Michael Nacht. I'm a professor of public policy in the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. A quick word about the Council. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and becomes the basis of informed action. To learn more about the organization, please refer to the card on your chair or visit www.itsyourworld.org. When you cannot attend a program, you can still stay informed by accessing the Council's podcasts and streaming audio and video online. Council programs can also be heard on the weekly one-hour radio show called It's Your World, which airs every Monday evening at 8 p.m. on National Public Radio, KQED 88.5 FM. Now, before we begin, please take a moment to turn off all cell phones and any other noise-making devices. While you do that, I'd like to take this opportunity to announce two upcoming events. Tomorrow, November 17th, the Council is pleased to host Dana Allen and Stephen Simon to discuss the Iranian nuclear challenge, the likelihood of an Israeli preventive strike, and the ongoing Israel-Palestine conflict. This event will take place here in the World Affairs Council Auditorium at 6 p.m. Then on Friday, November 19th, the Council will host Yonah Yahav, the mayor of the city of Haifa in Israel, to discuss Haifa as a model of coexistence in the Middle East. That event will be held in the World Affairs Council Auditorium at 1 p.m. Last, I would encourage you all to make use of the blue question cards that have been placed on your seats. Please hand them over to Council staff members. Audience questions will be posed to our speaker during the second half of our program. It is now my honor to introduce our distinguished guest this evening. Micah Zenko is a fellow in the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. Previously, he had a post at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government for 5 years, working in a number of research positions, as well as at the Brookings Institution, the Congressional Research Service, the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control, and the State Department's Office of Policy Planning. Dr. Zenko received a PhD in political science from Brandeis University. Here to offer us insight into discrete military operations, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Micah Zenko.
I'd like to thank Michael for the introduction and for the World Affairs Council for putting this together. I can make a quick endorsement for tomorrow's speaker, Steve Simon, who was a colleague of mine at the Council on Foreign Relations. Steve Simon, as many of you know, was a very senior official in the Clinton White House. Thinking about Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden in 1998, 99, 2000, and early parts of the Bush administration, actually. And Steve wrote a contingency planning memorandum for us at the Council on what an Israeli strike on Iran's suspected nuclear facilities would look like. It's about the most interesting and relevant description of how this could play out and how the United States should do contingency planning on behalf of it. And it's a great 8-page memo you can find on our website. So if you're free tomorrow night, Steve always has very, very interesting things to say and knows people very senior in government who are thinking about this, as well as people in Tel Aviv who are thinking about this. So I want to thank you again for coming out this evening. I understand San Francisco is a beautiful place, lots to go on, lots to do, so I appreciate people being here, and I appreciate the sort of the diversity in the audience, which for someone like me who lives on the Upper East Side of Manhattan and doesn't get a chance to talk to a lot of different folks, young and old, I get a chance to today, so thank you very much for this opportunity. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the book that I just had come out, which is called Between Threats and War, U.S. Discrete Military Operations in the Post-Cold War World, and talk a little bit about why it's relevant for the ongoing, as the Department of Defense likes to call it, the persistent state of conflict, which the United States might see itself at today. My book was an attempt to capture and evaluate a phenomenon. So a lot of people throughout history have thought about big wars, and this is in the political science world, the military history world, big wars like World War II, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, where the U.S. has a lot of forces deployed and it's nation-on-nation conflicts. And then on the one side, on the other side, people think about peacekeeping, stability operations, and even messier stuff, what we now call counterinsurgency operations. But nobody had ever really looked at the discrete, limited uses of military force. So these are sort of one-off, actual kinetic uses of military force on behalf of the United States. So the first thing you do is you think of the phenomenon, you think of a definition, and my sort of rough definition is a serial or single use of physical force with the intention of a military and political objective. And I'll talk a little bit about more of those than later. And then the second thing you come up with is an acronym. And the acronym that we landed was DMO, which means discrete, as in small, not secret, although many of these are secret, discrete military operations. So these DMOs are limited uses of force. And examples are special operation raids into Syria, Pakistan, unmanned drone strikes, which are very much in the news. The United States has now done, I looked it up this morning, 197 in Pakistan since 2004 when they first started. This is also limited bombing raids, such as occurred in the mid-90s four different times in Bosnia, as well as some of the attacks against the integrated air defense system of Iraq. This is also cruise missile strikes. One of my case studies in the book is the 1998 cruise missile strikes in Sudan and Afghanistan, as well as reportedly four or five of these, which has happened from December 09 to May 2010 off the coast of Yemen by the US Navy. So these are the sorts of things that have really occurred in greater numbers since the end of the Cold War. Needless to say, these were not just a post-Cold War event. I mean, going back to sort of the Mayaguez incident, if people are old enough to remember that, post-Vietnam, to President Reagan's limited strikes into places like Syria, Libya, Lebanon. So there have been these limited raids in the past, but they've increased at a pretty significant rate since the end of the Cold War. So the third thing you do is you look at the universe of cases, which is you try to collect data based upon this phenomenon, based upon this definition. And I came up with 31 different discrete military operations from 1991 through June 1st, 2009, although there's a very big caveat, which I could no longer keep collecting the data in Pakistan after June 2008 because they just start happening too fast, right? So there have been 160 under President Obama, and there were a little bit less than 40 under President Bush. And you really, they just come too fast to really understand what the political motivations for all of them, let alone the military effectiveness of all of them. So I sort of had to cut off data collection for those. My general finding is to be very skeptical about the use of limited military force. And this is based upon both the intended military and political objectives. Most people, if you watch Hollywood movies, if you look at YouTube videos, if you look at, in particular, the Pentagon often declassifies as after-action footage, video footage of limited bombing strikes. And you won't be surprised if the Pentagon doesn't declassify unsuccessful bombing strikes. If you go on the central, what's called AFCENT, which is a Central Command Air Force website, they have AC-130 gunship strikes, they have drone strikes in Iraq and Afghanistan, not in Yemen or Pakistan, because those are covert operations. But they have them, they show them, and they're pretty remarkable successes. And the lessons that people would take away is that the United States, with a defense budget, which is about to be passed, presumably in the lame duck session, the U.S. defense budget is going to be about $560 billion, another $150 billion to run the operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, a intelligence budget of $70 to $80 billion, not to mention a homeland defense budget of another $55 billion. So there's limitless money. The U.S. has, you know, almost 2 million, a little less than 2 million active duty military forces. U.S. has military presence in something like 140 countries around the world, and you'd have the impression, given all these resources, all these capabilities, all the technological advantage the United States has, that it can acquire a target anywhere on Earth and strike it and destroy it. And in fact, you can't. Some of the examples that I find that leads to suboptimal outcomes is the intelligence is wrong, which is a common thing that you see over and over again when you're trying to even strike stationary targets. The intelligence fails, weapon systems fail, the weapons platform that launches the weapon system fails, and then anything that involves, the other thing is weather. Weather is a huge factor you find in places like in Afghanistan and Iraq. Weather complicates the ability of the United States to do a lot of things to a degree people don't understand. And the final thing is human error, right? I mean, I have the one example in the book in February 2001, U.S. Central Command, which is the U.S. military command for the Middle East region, asked the very incoming Bush White House if they could destroy parts of the Iraqi air defense system that were located in central Iraq. And they made an appeal based upon increased threats to U.S. Pilots who were enforcing the southern no-fly zone. And the Bush administration said, sure, go ahead. We trust you. We're new to this, but you can go ahead and strike this. And so the U.S. launched 26 of these new type of weapon called the Joint Standoff Weapon, JSAW. 26 of them, 23 of them missed, all by the exact same distance. And the reason they all missed by the exact same distance is they were all programmed incorrectly, which means that three failed. But the 23 did exactly what they're supposed to do, and they missed as they should. I interviewed Vice Admiral Scott Fry, who was the director of operations at the time, and he told me about going to talk to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Hugh Shelton, and he sort of says, what the hell happened here? And I said, well, you know, our targeteers got it wrong. But they got them all wrong pretty consistently. And so that's a case of human error, but there's also cases of something like 2-5% of every cruise missile that's launched does not hit its intended target. And then some of them do hit the target, but the munition doesn't actually deploy, or the conventional explosive doesn't actually happen. So, you know, weapons fail, humans fail, intel fails. So that's what I found out militarily don't work. But then the other side of thing is nobody uses military force without some political objective, even if it's not really well thought out or really well articulated. Even if, you know, somebody shoots a round across the border from one country to another, there's a political intent, even if there's not a clear political objective. And so what I did for the universe of cases that I found was to assess them based upon the sort of common Thomas Schelling perspectives of political uses of force, which is punishment, deterrence, and compellence. You know, punishment is fairly easy to measure, which is you either destroyed the intended object or adversary, or you didn't. If you don't destroy the thing, the person doesn't feel the impact of what you're intending to do. Compellence is to try to, it's also known as coercive diplomacy, is to try to get your adversary to do something based upon the limited use of military force. And then deterrence is to try to stop your adversary from doing something. And so there's often a mix of political objectives, and I try to code them for success on what I call, you know, success, mixed success, or failure. And my basic finding here is that limited military force achieves all of its intended political objectives roughly 7% of the time. If you do success and mixed success, it's a little bit better. It's about half of the time. One very notable success was in 1993, the former President Bush 41 was in Kuwait. There was an alleged attempt to assassinate him. The FBI, there was actually two parallel investigations. They do a pretty deep dig into whether or not the Iraqi security forces are behind it, and they say they are. It's probably the Iraqi intelligence services. President Clinton, in the summer of 93, launches a bunch of cruise missiles at the Iraqi intelligence headquarters, destroys the building, so it achieves its intended political objective, a military objective, I'm sorry. But what was the intended political objective? Well, it was to punish them for this attempted assassination attempt, but the primary objective was to deter Iraq from supporting international terrorism. And after the fact, there's no evidence that Iraq did support international terrorist plots against the United States. So there's a case where it works out very clearly. More often than not, it does not work out very clearly. And if you look at what's going on today in Afghanistan, if you look at the limited strikes in Yemen, if you look at the limited strikes in Somalia, the Obama administration will also use this, the three Ds, which is disrupt, dismantle, or defeat. And that's the goal. And then who you're disrupting, dismantling, and defeat is another question. If you're making a broad sweep, you'll say Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. But the real objective is to deter Al-Qaeda and its affiliates from using the tribal areas of Pakistan to plan international terrorist plots. And after 6.5 years and 200 strikes, drone strikes into Pakistan, have they succeeded? And if you read the latest State Department annual report for terrorism, if you listen to the senior national security policymakers in the National Security Council and the State Department, I've had a chance to talk to them, and they say, you know, Northwest Pakistan remains the beating heart of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda and its affiliates continue to train recruits, plan international terrorist plots, disseminate propaganda, provide strategic guidance for both Al-Qaeda and its franchises throughout the world. And almost every significant international terrorist plot since 9/11 emanates from Northwest Pakistan, which leads you to ask the question of, are these drone strikes doing what they're intended to do? Well, they're doing something, and the U.S. has succeeded in killing a lot of people, but we also know that al-Qaeda has succeeded in recreating a lot of the people that we've killed. So, for example, the number 10 official of al-Qaeda has been killed, or the person that the U.S. government identifies as al-Qaeda's number 3 official has been killed something like 10 or 11 times. The current number 3 al-Qaeda official, his name is Mohammed Ilya Kashmiri. He was targeted by a drone strike in the summer of 2010. The U.S. government believed they had killed him. 2 months later, he gave an interview with Asia Times Online to point out that, in fact, he hadn't been killed, and he remains alive to this day. So the U.S. could kill the 12th number 3 al-Qaeda official, and I assume we will. The U.S. could continue to kill Pakistan Taliban officials and mid-level operatives whose primary goal is to take down the apostate regime in Islamabad. They could continue to kill al-Qaeda people, Lashkar-e-Taiba, the group that was involved in the Mumbai attacks. But there are something like 6 million military-aged males in the tribal areas of Pakistan. And this is the highly unpopulated area of Pakistan. If you go further to the cities, there's 180 million people in Pakistan. And you come up a lot more problems if the militarism spreads from the tribal areas, which there's some evidence that it will be at some point. So the question is, what are you trying to do here? And General David Petraeus says it best: when you cannot capture, you kill your way out of the problem. You cannot kill 6 million military age males, although we're trying. And you are likely creating more people who have greater anger at you at the time. This is just Pakistan. A similar story is going on today in Yemen. A similar story is going on in Somalia, where in 2007, the government of Ethiopia, with the intelligence and firepower support of the United States, overthrew the al-Shabaab ruling government in Mogadishu and replaced the current government in Mogadishu, which essentially rules a couple blocks around the capital. And the U.S. has done 5 limited discrete military operations since then. 4 of them, by the Pentagon's own definition, have failed. One of them did succeed in capturing one of the people connected to the 98 East African embassy bombings. A similar story is going on in Yemen, where the United States did 5 cruise missile strikes from December 2009 through May 2010, all of which, by most accounts, probably didn't do a lot. The December 2009 one, according to the Yemeni government, killed 41 civilians out of 43 total, killed. The May 2010 one killed the deputy provincial governor of the Marib region, and since then there's been none. Now, there are drones armed with Hellfire missiles flying over Yemen today, and undoubtedly there will be greater pressure to use them, and there will be strikes that happen relatively soon. But without the sort of full range of diplomatic, economic development tools that the U.S. puts into place, they won't be successful. So what I tell people is, be very skeptical of the use of limited military force on its own achieving much, and consider all the other elements of national power that have to be put into place alongside military force. The good news is there was no comprehensive strategy for Pakistan or Afghanistan until December 2009. There is now a comprehensive strategy. You can go to the State Department website. Secretary Clinton and Secretary Gates have signed it. You can see and try to understand how military force is used in coordination with all these other strategies of power. There was no comprehensive strategy for Yemen until April 2009, when General David Petraeus, on his own, decided that there was, USAID, State Department, all the other U.S. government agencies working at odds with each other at times to achieve something. And so there is greater understanding, in part with the counterinsurgency mindset that has really cemented itself in the military and among a lot of younger senior policymakers, that military force on its own will not achieve much. The counterinsurgency motto is clear, hold, and build, which is you go into a defined territory, you clear it of its adversaries, you then hold it to allow people and to protect civilians to come back in, and then you rebuild to allow people the opportunities to hopefully not rejoin insurgents or terrorist groups. My book is about discrete military operations, and there, what I like to describe them as clear and disappear, which is there's a drone strike or a cruise missile strike that comes at about 2:45 a.m. It is often very successful at killing the intended person, and then there's no follow-up. And not only that, but as is accordance with Muslim custom, people are buried before sunset, and the U.S. does not clearly know who they kill off some of the time. They don't get DNA samples. It's hard to get follow-up, although the U.S. does everything in its power to prevent civilian casualties often. So that's my basic pitch for the book, is to be very skeptical about what limited military force can achieve. But I'm much more interested in what your questions are and what else you'd find interesting. So please.
Thank you very much. An initial question from a member of our audience asks, how does Israel stack up on the three political objectives of limited force operations in comparison to the United States?
Yeah, I'm actually disappointed in myself that I haven't gone to Israel yet. I was there 2 summers ago, already starting to formulate and talk about this issue. I mean, Israel does a lot of discrete military operations. I mean, you can debate whether or not raids into the occupied territories are, or into Palestine, or whatever you want to call it, are discrete military operations, but Israel does operations outside of that. So in 2007, they did destroy the makings of a suspected graphite reactor in Syria. They've done raids into the Red Sea to destroy ships carrying Hezbollah-linked supplies for, supplies reportedly heading to Hezbollah. They've done raids into Sudan, where there are also Hezbollah groups who train. And, you know, I sitting on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, I'm very uncomfortable telling other countries. I mean, I'm uncomfortable telling Washington what to do. I have no responsibility. I just research this stuff and make my best effort forward. And I'm even less comfortable telling Tel Aviv what they should do. But, you know, you ask the question of whether or not the limited strikes have achieved its intended effect by the government of Israel against the Palestinian people, and you'd have to answer no. The government of Israel might be safer for the time being, but, I mean, you go to Israel, nobody thinks military force is going to resolve the problem. There it's an issue of development. It's primarily issues of demography if you want to have a Jewish homeland. So on the sort of punishment, deterrence, compellence scale, Israel's very good at punishing people, trying to prevent civilians being killed in these limited strikes, but have they deterred the intended objective of preventing people from strike or holding at risk Israel, whether it's from southern Lebanon or from the occupied territories? I would say no.
Okay. Staying in the same region, what discrete operations exist to counter the threat from Iran, and what are the chances for success?
Well, I look at, so kinetic, actual uses of limited force. A lot of people in the, what if you're in a political scientist or you read international relations, they have what's called the coercive diplomacy. Coercive diplomacy can be the use of force or the threat of force. I look at actual uses of force. To my knowledge, there's been no U.S. strikes against Iran. There are assuredly, as early as 07, we know that there were unmanned drones that fly over Iran, not to mention lots of satellites, and I'm sure things that are somewhere between satellites and drones that are conducting surveillance, and there's lots of human intelligence. And there are many, many, for many years, people in the Central Command planning staff have thought about how to bomb Iran's suspected nuclear facilities. They've played out this scenario many times. If you talk to people in the U.S. government under a couple different administrations, they don't know where all the facilities are located. I would ask Steve Simon tomorrow night, who can give you a better sense of what this might look like. But I would also add, I've never met a senior U.S. military official who is in favor of just trying to strike Iran's nuclear facilities. They recognize this as a slippery slope to something much, much worse. My question I always ask people when they propose using military force to achieve anything is, I say, and then what? Right? It's pretty simple to bomb things, and the United States has assets all over the world to bomb things at a moment's notice, and then what? What's your theory of victory for how a limited use of military force plays out in a way that achieves your desired end state? It's hard to imagine how the U.S., first of all, it doesn't know where all Iran's facilities are, so you can't just bomb. You're probably going to have people on the ground doing after-action assessments of soil samples and everything else, and you might want to have some more boots on the ground to look for facilities that are probably 60 to 70 meters underground to protect themselves from things dropped from the sky. So there's no known limited uses of force in Iran yet. But the U.S. is thinking about it in a very serious way, and more than the U.S. is thinking about it, the government of Israel has thought about this. They've threatened it. I have no doubt that the current government in Israel, from the head of the IAF to Prime Minister Netanyahu to the head of the MOD, they were elected for the one primary purpose, which is not to come to agreement with the Palestinians on the future of a Palestinian state, but it's to prevent Iran from getting the bomb. And I have no doubt that if they believe the international community won't do it, that they will do it on their own.
Okay. The questions are quite diverse, so we'll test your latitude.
It's like tennis.
Exactly. We're going to move you from one part of the court to the other. So this is a topic that you haven't explicitly addressed. 50% of Afghanistan's 2007 GDP came from opium exports. How important do top U.S. military officials give narco trafficking within the larger counterinsurgency framework? And have many discrete military operations targeted this source of insurgent and terrorist funding?
Well, as I mentioned, I don't look at limited uses of force in Iraq or Afghanistan, because those are what I would consider sort of declared battlefields. There's a war going on. There's lots of DMOs that happen in war sites all the time, and people are sort of studying it to death. The specific question of narco trafficking, my latest reading of it from colleagues of mine who work on the special representative Richard Holbrooke's staff is that the narco trafficking as a source of income for the Taliban is significantly overrated, that there is plenty of other sources of funding from the Persian Gulf region in particular that the Taliban has to rely upon, not to mention anything that goes in and out of Afghanistan. And are there limited uses of force working on targeting this? I would suspect no, because the primary goal is not to go after the money on the first as a first tier objective, because that money also deals and infects third-party neutrals and other people you need to buy off in terms of reconciliation and political accommodation. Limited uses of force are these, as Prime Minister Karzai warns about, are these night raids, which are going after a very specific prioritized target set of people who threaten deployed U.S. forces, who threaten the government, and you might want to bring in for interrogation to go after other prized target sets.
Returning for a minute to the United States, this is a question that you can take in different directions. Do discrete military operations have any U.S. domestic rationale?
Sure. I mean, it's I've written about this, and you can look on my website and find most things I've written. But these are, you know, when I give this pitch, people in the military shake their head and they go, right, you know, we're not greatly in favor of these, but civilian officials are much more likely to propose, debate, and support uses of limited military force for a lot of reasons, primarily that there's a chronic, persistent foreign policy problem, and they need to do something. And they need to demonstrate they're doing something to a wider audience. And there's no more alluring, responsive tool in the U.S. foreign policy toolkit than military force. You know, I always use this quote of President Clinton when he turns to George Stephanopoulos in 1994, before the 82nd Airborne is ready to do a raid on Haiti. He says, the military is impressive, isn't it? And it is. The military is they have amazing capabilities, resources around the world. They're also really, really, really good at planning. I get to spend a lot of time with people on the three staffs. So the military, you know, they quantify everything. One is personnel, two is intelligence, three is operations. And I spend a lot of time on the three operations side of things. And they can plan anything, you know, and not just military things. So just like in Afghanistan today, the military is doing things the military used to not do. But one of the reasons they do it is they have a lot of resources and they're really good at planning. So the military, especially limited force, is a very responsive, persuasive tool that has very immediate impacts. My point is that those immediate impacts aren't lasting. They don't really achieve your intended objectives. They don't really affect the desired end state, especially if it's to use and to pull away. But the one important thing they do is they don't put U.S. soldiers at risk. The people controlling the drones over Pakistan today live in Las Vegas. They work out of Creech Air Base near Las Vegas. They have it's a very difficult mission. It doesn't belittle their mission at all. They work 12-hour shifts. You know, people think there's one person flying a drone. It's actually, the rule of thumb is it takes 10 people to keep one drone flying. There's a targeter. There's someone who operates the actual drone. They work 12-hour shifts. They have post-traumatic stress disorder as great as soldiers deployed to Afghanistan. they take their jobs very, very seriously. They're very careful about it. But in the end, they don't die. And so the body count doesn't have to go up, and it doesn't have greater rationale for people in the Pentagon and the White House to explain why the U.S. is deployed abroad. So it's low-cost, responsive tool to the U.S., but it is at to some impact for the people who are on the end of where these bombs go off.
Well, following up on the drone issue specifically, a questioner asks, have the recent advances in drone technology influenced the rise of discrete military operations? That's one part of the question. And should drone operations themselves be controlled by international law? Should the U.S. support efforts to legally limit drone use?
That's a very – I'll just take the second one first. Last week – or this was a couple days ago, I'm sorry – at the Council on Foreign Relations, I had Philip Alston, who was the U.N. Special Rapporteur for Extrajudicial Killings and Murder. So he's an NYU law professor who works for the U.N. Human Rights Council, and I had him come in and speak, as well as Ashley Deeks, who is the former State Department legal advisor on behalf of this. There is a big debate about whether or not drones fall under international humanitarian law, under international human rights law. According to successive administrations, there's the Bush administration released on November 13th, 2001, what's called Military Order Number 1. Military Order Number 1 says, as a consequence of the attacks of 9/11, al-Qaeda and affiliated groups created a state of war upon the United States. Therefore, any military operations done that fall under the state of war that was created on the United States is an act of war and falls under the LOAC, or Laws of Armed Conflict. Therefore, it should not be included under the sort of international humanitarian law. But on November 8th, if people are really interested in this topic, the United States appeared before the Human Rights Council to defend its human rights policy. Every country in the UN, all 192 UN member states, had to appear before the Human Rights Council. The US happened to just appear earlier this month under a process called the Universal Periodic Review. And one of the things that was raised was, what is the accountability for these uses of force? Describe the legal proceedings. But for the most part, the international community is looking the other way on these, on drone strikes and taking a pass at them. I think it's a bad idea. Same reason I think it's a bad idea to not have some existing international regime or at least discussion about cyber warfare, because the U.S. is really good at cyber warfare and cyber attacks today, but in the future we'll be just one of many countries who are good at it. And just because we're out front today doesn't mean other countries won't be out front in the future. And there are many other countries interested and many other bad guys who are interested in getting drones, and they will fly them and threaten the United States and U.S. deployed forces in the future. And the first part of that question was again?
The first part is, have the advances in technology itself led to a great increase in their use in these discrete movements?
Yeah, I mean, it's a case of technology being the driver, because before in 1995, well, drones for surveillance purposes have been around since Vietnam. They were used in a big way to enforce the Dayton Peace Accords in the mid-90s. You can read all about this in the 9/11 Commission, but they were thinking about how do you get after bin Laden without deploying forces in Afghanistan. Vice Admiral Scott Fry, who was the director of operations, turned to his assistant, a guy named Brigadier General Scott Gratian, who, by the way, is now putting the Darfur Peace Agreement. He's the Obama administration's guy in charge of the South Sudan referendum and the Darfur comprehensive peace agreement for Sudan. And he looked at, well, how can we go after these guys? Well, we have unmanned drones, and what we could do is we could put anti-tank missiles on them. That's the Hellfire missile. And so they put anti-tank missiles on the end of these drones. They tried them out for a long time. By 1999-2000, they had done a couple strikes in testing grounds, and then there's a big fight between the CIA and the Pentagon who's going to pay for it. But after the U.S. invades in Afghanistan, they start going in a real big way. But for the most part, this is still a very, very new technology, and the drones are only going to get they're going to have more firepower. They're going to be more autonomous. So in the future, there won't just be one person controlling one drone. There'll be one person controlling 10 drones, because drones are really good for anything that falls under the three Ds again, which is dull, dirty, or dangerous. Drones can loiter above a target for a day and decide when to strike it, or it can collect intelligence to shoot back and then land and then go up the next day. They'll be more powerful, they'll fly higher, they'll fly longer distances, they'll be more accurate, they'll be more precise, And in many ways, they're the future. And if you look at the Air Force is having a very big debate right now about what the next long-range bomber is going to be. And they're talking about making what's called dual option, so it can be manned or unmanned. Because there are certain situations where you want a pilot in the air above a target, because it's weather conditions, the threat environment is very fluid. You have to make decisions that instant, and you can't do that. There's, you know, a slight delay in relaying electronic transmissions back to Nevada. But I think this technology will only increase. The numbers will increase. It will grow and grow, and there'll be more DMLs as a consequence of the tool.
Okay. Thank you. We have a couple of questions on other countries. One is on another question on Sudan, which you just cited, and there's also a question on Cuba. So on Sudan, I'll lump them together quickly and just ask you to respond as you see fit. Sudan has begun the referendum process. Have U.S. limited strikes been related to the North-South divide? And has Israel struck in Sudan, and if so, why?
Israel did strike in Sudan, believed to be in 2009 at least once, probably more than once, because there are, going back to 15 years, Sudan has been a place of a lot of international terrorist groups. I mean, it's where bin Laden was from 92 to 96, and there are still lots of foreign terrorist organizations who can operate for Sudan, including Hezbollah, and Israel has struck suspected Hezbollah sites in Sudan. I know of no U.S. limited strikes in Sudan at any point since 1998. There are people, though, who, like Nicholas Kristof and others who have sort of called for a no-fly zone over Darfur, and now they've said if the Bashir government, quote, initiates genocide after the referendum in January, this is a referendum about whether or not South Sudan will remain part of Sudan or will break away and form an independent country, and there's issues about resettlement, there's issues about how to redistribute oil wealth. But the Comprehensive Peace Agreement of 2005 set the referendum 5 years in advance. It was a big cornerstone of Bush administration foreign policy in Africa, and everyone wants the referendum to go well. They're way behind schedule. They're just registering people now. There's hundreds of things that need to go right before the referendum happens in January. And it's highly likely there could be a conflict. Both sides are arming themselves to the teeth and getting ready to fight for the land that they both believe is theirs. People like Nick Kristof and others have said, well, if the Bashir government, who has conducted genocide before, as they did in Darfur, if they begin some sort of mass scorched earth campaign against civilians, the U.S. should intervene on behalf of South Sudan using limited force. I don't necessarily think that's a good idea in the abstract, but that's what people are debating right now. There's lots of contingency planning for Sudan going on right now in Washington, a great deal. It's a big, big worry.
On the Cuba side, one question is notes that it was reported years ago that the U.S. was involved in efforts to assassinate Fidel Castro, including using exploding cigars. Mm-hmm. Probably not an area that you've been focusing on. So is this sort of planning part of discrete military operations today?
Well, I would say any targeted killing is, and no matter how you do it, those are discrete military operations, although the cigar never went to Castro. You can look at the Church and the Pike committees in the mid-70s, which dug into these in great detail and lots of revelations. And since then, there's much greater oversight over covert operations. There is the House, the HIPC, the House Intelligence Permanent Committee. There's the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Mm-hmm. And these people do pretty significant oversight of these sorts of operations. So there isn't a lot of exploding cigars any longer. But that doesn't mean that crazy ideas don't get pitched around when people in the Deputies Committee meeting in the National Security Council are thinking about how do we deal with this problem, how do we deal with that problem. We're not at exploding cigars yet. We've become a little more sophisticated. But that's, I'm sure, somewhere in the toolkit.
As a former dean at Berkeley, I was always concerned about getting exploding cigars from my faculty. It was a very serious threat. But that's for a classified session. You mentioned very briefly in response to a previous question about CIA and the DOD disputing the costs. So there's a broader question here from one of our members of the audience, and that is there a real conflict between CIA and the military on this? And is it is there an increasing militarization of these operations that's good or bad? I mean, can you just enlighten us on that relationship?
Well, there was historically a very significant split between the Pentagon and the CIA. And you talk to people in the Pentagon, they always talk – people in the Pentagon always worry about unity of command. They want one person in charge. And as it stands right now, nominally, unmanned Predator drones fly into Pakistan. They're under the control of the CIA. They're covert operations under 1947 law, which means the U.S. government cannot defend or explain them away. Drones fly over Afghanistan, do the same operations. They fall under the Pentagon. And the Pentagon will release press releases explaining whether or not they work or not. There's data. They release quarterly data about civilian, or the UN collects data released about civilian kills. The Pentagon defends and explains them. In reality, they actually share drones. So some of the same drones that fly over Pakistan one day fly over Afghanistan the other day. There's not one air operations center for the CIA and one for the Pentagon. There's actually one. It's a combined air operations center. It looks at all what they call blue force tracking, which is all good guys and wherever they fly. So they're working together in a much more synergistic way than they were before. The big debate, though, is in places like Yemen, which is in Yemen right now, there are drones flying over Yemen. They are reportedly under the control of the military. When they're under the control of the military, that means the ambassador gets a little more of a say probably than when they're under the control of the CIA. In November 2002, one of the case studies in my book, I mentioned there was a CIA-controlled drone in November 3rd, 2002, which struck and killed the land cruiser as it was speeding away. It killed six guys, including Abu al-Harethi, who was connected to the 98 bombings, and one of the Lackawanna Six, Kamal Derwish, who was a U.S. citizen. That was a CIA-controlled drone. Now, there's a lot of interchange. There's a lot of intermixing of resources. The CIA does not have an army. They do not have their own sort of air force. They rely upon DOD assets seconded to them. And my understanding is talking to people is there's much greater understanding of who you're going after. There's much greater cooperation than there ever has been as a result of a consequence of having to work together.
I guess it would not be surprising that the issue of Osama bin Laden's whereabouts would come up in this context.
I can't help you.
Just can you give us the approximate number? The question is, are we continuing to search for Osama bin Laden? What's the likelihood of success? How will this affect our war, our struggle against international terrorist groups?
Yeah, I mean, human beings are very adaptable, and based on Darwinian impulse, they like to survive. You think about the gentleman they tried to... the abortion clinic bomber in Kentucky who lived 6 years despite in Kentucky, which might be worse than North Waziristan in Pakistan, I don't know. And Eric Rudolph, he was able to hide in a way that people who lived their whole lives in Kentucky couldn't find him. The U.S. has a very poor idea of what the tribal areas of Pakistan are. They have poor intelligence. They don't really know the societal connections, the tribal makeup, the identities. There's lots of places where they've never penetrated. There's lots of places where there's never been any control. It's very likely he's in North Waziristan living very buried. But we know that he reads the news. We know that he's able to get out audio messages. There has to be a way that that happens, and some of them are quite recent. So he's... he's able to communicate and provide strategic guidance in a way that is still incredibly threatening to the United States. If he were captured or killed, that would be a wonderful thing, both for the justice of all of the people whose blood is on his hands. Mm-hmm. But it's unlikely to happen anytime relatively soon. I think they're doing everything they can, given the limits that the government of Pakistan puts on U.S. presence there. I think the United States does just about everything it can, but that wasn't always the case. I mean, I talked to people who were in the Central Command world in 04, 05, 06, and they just said, bin Laden's a ghost. We don't spend a lot of time looking for him. We have an insurgency in Iraq we need to worry about. Bin Laden was not a tier one priority. I think he is a tier one priority now. I think there are several hundreds of people whose lives are collecting intelligence and trying to find him, but we're not very good at understanding what that region looked like, and therefore we're not going to be very likely to find him anytime soon.
I do recall a recent published report that, I don't know if it was just speculation, that he and Zawahiri were actually living in homes, not in primitive environments, in the northern, in the tribal territories.
That's, Likely, very likely.
A couple of the questions sort of go to the core of the issue of if this isn't working that well or isn't nearly as effective, then, you know, what are the alternatives? Mm-hmm. So one is, first of all, are your skeptical views about the efficacy of these operations getting traction in Washington? You mentioned Pakistan and Yemen. What's the then what in those places if we don't do this?
Right. Well, we know a lot about how terrorist groups end, and we know a lot about how insurgencies end. There's been more data collection on this than you can imagine since 9/11. And the way terrorist groups end are twofold. One is political accommodation or reconciliation, and the second is penetration and disruption by intelligence and police forces. Military force, according to the one major study by the RAND Association, I'm sorry, by the RAND Corporation, is that they found military force to be the essential tool to ending terrorist groups less than 7% of the time. So military force on its own won't do it. The problem is that all the other things you need to do, including political accommodation and reconciliation, the building the capacity of the host government to go after these forces, providing a just and competent government so neutral third parties don't join terrorist forces, isn't happening. And what I found is that limited military force is the oxygen that sucks all the air out of the interagency debate. So there's always a debate about, we need to do something about Yemen. Well, what do we have? Well, we have limited military force. It's a responsive tool. We have ships off the coast of Yemen. They can launch cruise missiles in and do something about it. But the persistent underlying conditions which allow people to support al-Qaeda there remain and persist. So how do you deal with that? Well, that's long-term, comprehensive, coordinated, prioritized strategy involving all the elements of national power. And it involves building up the capacity of the host government to penetrate these groups, to disrupt them, to arrest people, to build greater intelligence and to take them down. And it has some component of political accommodation, reconciliation, so they come in from the cold. And we don't do that. The default position, because we need to do something quickly, is we continue to rely on military force. So the and then what is everything else that I mentioned that takes a really long time to oversee and implement, and it's going to take multiple administrations and buy-in from hopefully the host government to some extent and the absorptive capacity for us to build up their security forces. But that doesn't happen in large part because we don't make the long-term strategic partnership with these countries. And we don't have, and the persistent chronic underfunding of the civilian foreign policy apparatus in the United States. You know, the foreign affairs budget this year will be roughly 8% of the Pentagon's budget. So the State Department gets 8% of what the Pentagon gets. Secretary Gates, the Pentagon always uses this line, there are more people in military marching bands than State Department foreign affairs officers. There are something like 1,600 to 2,000 USAID officials who are supposed to be the people who are doing development work in Afghanistan and elsewhere, and they've been chronically underfunded for decades. And when we call upon them to try to create the conditions on the ground that don't allow terrorist groups to emerge, they're not there to do it. And so most people in Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, and elsewhere aren't interested. I mean, we now have really great public opinion and polling from Northwest Pakistan, and two things are determined. One, people don't like drone strikes. Two, they don't like the Taliban in roughly equal numbers. So they're wet clay. They're open to suggestion. They're open to be bought off. And if they're provided with opportunities, they won't join the Taliban, and they won't provide support for people who do things that we don't like. But that takes a lot of time and a lot of work. And the U.S. government isn't organized well because of the underfunding of the civilian resources to do that, nor is the government of Islamabad really that interested in doing things about it, in part because we don't have a long-term strategic partnership with the government of Pakistan.
So, again, does that mean that it's recognized, you think, by senior leaders that there are these limitations, but in a way we haven't, it's the least worst alternative?
It
would require a restructuring of the whole funding apparatus in Washington, which is clearly not feasible.
Yeah, it is the least worst. And, if you read Secretary Gates' speech, he says over and over again, military force on its own won't do it. He keeps saying, please, he goes on Capitol Hill. There's an amazing letter, you can find them, which were written to the House and Senate Appropriations Committee. There's an open letter with personal handwritten signatures from Admiral Mullen, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Secretary Gates, begging Congress to fund the State Department at higher levels, recognizing that military force on its own won't do things. And they know that limited force, especially people in the military, won't resolve the problem. But in the meantime, it is the least worst alternative to other feasible solutions. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be reorganizing ourselves to implement those as well.
Shifting gears a little bit to methodology, I think we're all impressed by your extraordinary wealth of knowledge and information on what, in many cases, are very sensitive subjects. So one of the questioners asks, how did you conduct research for this project? Is your information all publicly available on DOD websites? Or how did you get access to these people and learn about this as a non-government official?
Well, if you want to learn about how the U.S. government works, I wouldn't start with the DOD website because it's better than it used to be, but defenselink.mil is not user-friendly. A lot of the stuff, they are, as nominally said, covert operations, so U.S. government officials cannot explain them or defend them, but I sat at Harvard for 5 years, and lots of people sort of rotate through looking to get executive education training, or they come to give lectures, and they're bored, and you interview them. And when they won't be interviewed, you follow them down to Washington, and you sit outside their office, and you try to interview them. And if they won't talk to you, you interview actually their underlings, who probably know more than the officials do, and they might be more willing to talk. And then people leave government. And so my methodology is find people who recently left government. They love to talk to reporters, and you can see where they are. They're often in lobbying firms in Virginia or Maryland, and you just pick up the phone. And by the way, they're now working for a defense think tank or a consulting firm in their board, and they feel impressed that someone comes down from Harvard and talks to them. And so it's just chasing people down and talking to them over and over and over and over again. But it's also reconstructing the cases based upon what's available in newspapers and on the news. And, you know, I'm always amazed when I talk to journalists, and I hope no one here is a journalist, to the extent of how lazy they are. I mean, there's a lot you can learn if you pick up a newspaper. There's a lot you can learn if you read congressional testimony, if you read the Congress makes a lot of reporting requirements on the State Department and the Pentagon. They have to release too many reports. It wastes a lot of time. Yep. Take a look at them. Information's out there. Just because the topics are sensitive don't mean you can know a lot about them and make a real common citizen's analysis of whether or not it works.
One of our questioners asked you to return to the days of Secretary Rumsfeld and his restructuring of the Defense Department, including the establishment of an Undersecretary for Intelligence,
The
feuds between DOD and CIA. And are some of the seeds of discrete military operations coming from those years and those measures, or is that not where to look for some of the seeds of this?
I think Rumsfeld was on to something about how to get, Rumsfeld had nefarious goals and realistic ones. One was to create his own separate intelligence streams to support the justification of the invasion of Iraq. The second was to provide greater intelligence to deployed forces in the field, including threats to them from things like IED, which the Defense Intelligence Agency and the CIA didn't do a very good job of collecting. So in that sense, I think it was useful. But I don't necessarily think that the increase in limited operations are a consequence of his restructuring of the Pentagon, which in many ways I think was overdue. And as you see it sticking under Secretary Gates, and I suspect when Secretary Gates steps down, it will stick when he leaves as well.
I think, unfortunately, we only have time for one more question. And the questioner asks, is your skepticism about the utility of discrete military operations, can one impute from that extended to broader skepticism or skepticism about other military, other uses of military force, both during the Cold War and after the Cold War?
It's funny you mention that. This is something that I'd really like to write about. The sort of working title I have in my mind is What Military Force Doesn't Do. Because a lot of people now have done these policy evaluative studies about what military force we thought was good at, and it turns out it's not very good at. So we now know that military force is not very good at strategic bombing. There's a famous book by Bob Pape called Bombing to Win. Tammy Biddle as well has done a good study of strategic bombing. We know that the military actually isn't good at naval blockades. There's people studying this now. We also know that the military force is not very good at targeted killings of leadership. So there's a famous scholar who I respect a lot at University of Chicago named Jenna Jordan. She looked at 297 different what's called leadership decapitation attempts. Mm-hmm. This is trying to kill senior leaders of terrorist or insurgent organizations, and it works about 17% of the time. And the other thing she finds out is that when you don't target the senior leader, that group is more likely to collapse. So there's a lot of things that military force doesn't do. But in the absence of people with patience and an understanding of what military force realistically does, it's relied upon over and over and over again. A bit of the issues that I try to raise in the book are why people should be very skeptical of this and consider the other elements of national power in lieu of the quick, responsive, attractive, alluring aspect of limited military force.
Well, unfortunately, we are now out of time. So on behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Council on Foreign Relations, I would like to thank Dr. Zenko for providing us with his very stimulating thoughts and insights, and many thanks to the audience as well for your terrific questions. I'd like also to mention and remind you that Dr. Zenko's book is available for sale, courtesy of Books Incorporated, and he'll be available to sign copies here on stage. Thank you and good night.
Thank you.